Gunshots and explosions in Paris again today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An early morning police raid rattles a Paris suburb.
I heard the gunshot. So again, sometimes it was maybe the terrorist, and some other time was the police was shooting.
The cops were looking for the alleged mastermind behind last week's attacks. We'll have the latest. Also, the hacktivist group Anonymous takes on ISIS.
3 years ago, if you asked me would Anonymous ever fight terrorists, I probably would have said no.
Plus, how the current U.S. debate over Syrian refugees echoes a similar debate over Jewish refugees during World War II.
Rushing into policies in the immediate aftermath of an attack or a security threat can have long-term implications that we should be very careful about.
That's all coming up today on The World. It's good to be with you. And again this hour, our focus is on the aftershocks from last Friday's attacks on Paris, a city still on edge because, especially after today, people there are not sure what comes next. This morning, before Parisians had even woken up, a new disturbing chapter to the story. Police raided an apartment in the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis. They were looking for the suspected mastermind behind Friday's attacks. After a seven-hour standoff, two of the apartment's occupants were dead, one of them a woman who blew herself up. Seven people were arrested during the operation, but in the end, the alleged mastermind was not found, and his whereabouts are unknown. We'll hear more about him in a few minutes. We begin, though, with The World's Leo Hornack, who visited Saint-Denis after the raid and spoke with some of the residents there.
I mean, this is the other France, really. This is the Paris you don't see in films and romantic comedies. Saint-Denis is one of the most economically depressed areas in France. Its unemployment rate was 16% higher than France as a whole. So you have to imagine when you go in there that you are seeing people who really are not part of mainstream French society in a way. It's the kind of place which normally is quite bustling with kind of multicultural shops, people from all over the world living there. Many undocumented migrants live in Saint-Denis. But when I went there this morning, all the shops were shut. Some residents milling around on the street. A little boy leant out of a window as we walked past shouting, "Go the police," in French, "go the police." So, you know, for kids, it's kind of a spectacle. And that's what everyone was doing. They were just watching this strange thing that had happened in their neighborhood.
Did you speak with anyone, Leo, who had a close-up view of the police raid or who heard the gunfire? It sounded like a lot of people heard it.
The whole neighborhood heard, you know, at around 4 in the morning or 4:30, it began. And you could speak to anyone within a few streets to hear just how loud that was, particularly the explosion, which we think would have been a suicide vest being detonated, was a huge sound that was heard across the whole neighborhood. I spoke to some residents just one street away.
I wake up in the morning to go and work, so I see a lot of police here. So I was shocked. I came outside. I want to see what is happening, but police asked me to, "You cannot go outside. You must stay at your home." But yeah, it's shocking for us. This was a bit calm area before, but now it's shocking for us.
I heard the gunshot. It's not like some people having fun with something. It's like, okay, it's gunshots, many gunshots. And it's like the sounds is like ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So again, sometimes it was maybe the terrorist, and some other time was the police was shooting. Maybe at 5:38, there was an explosion, a bigger one. The person exploded herself, and then we didn't hear anything.
So a violent, violent night in Paris on Friday, raids continuing throughout the weekend, and then, you know, something like this with lots of exchange of fire. Is there any sense of life getting back to normal in Paris yet?
I don't think so, Marco. Everything in a way is on edge, particularly a day like this morning. I mean, even the police officers kind of manning the perimeter were on edge, and you could see the nerves in their eyes. And there's been a huge deployment. More than 100,000 police and military have been mobilized. So this is something that is kind of shaking the country. I mean, there is another side to this. And I did speak to one slightly older resident. His name is Youssef Lounis. He's been there since the early 1950s. He said he heard the explosions. He lives just a street or two away, but he wasn't afraid for the reputation of Saint-Denis or its future.
Bien sûr, qui n'a pas peur de la mort?
Of course, who isn't afraid of death? I know the history of France. I don't have any fear for our reputation because this is a town of kings, a royal city. France is a rainbow. It is multicultural. It is plural.
What does Mr. Lunas actually mean by all the kings are here?
Well, I mean, Saint-Denis is now this extremely depressed, deprived neighborhood. But in years gone by, it was the place where all the kings of France tombs were kept. So he's referring to this proud history that even a neighborhood like this has, and how he hopes that it can kind of keep that reputation and that pride going forward.
The World's Leo Hornack in Paris. Thanks very much, Leo.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's hear more now about the alleged ringleader behind the Paris attacks. He's still at large, as I said earlier. His name is Abdelhamid Abaoud. The Wall Street Journal has been digging into his story, so we called Grania McCarthy, the journal's Paris bureau chief.
He's Belgian-born. He was raised in Belgium. He's 28 years old, and he is believed to be a senior Islamic State operative. He is connected to a failed plot earlier this year outside the Belgian capital of Brussels, where apparently the plot was to behead Belgian police officers. Police foiled that plot just after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris in January, and two of his suspected accomplices were killed at the time. And around about that time, officials believed that Mr. Abaoud escaped to Syria.
Right. He may have also been involved in that train attack foiled by young Americans earlier this year, that train that was traveling south from Brussels to France.
French and Belgian intelligence services suspect that. And of course, they now have suspect that he was the mastermind behind last Friday's terror attacks here. One of the stories we reported earlier this week, just to kind of put in context how senior an Islamic State operative he is viewed by Western countries, we reported that Western nations tried to kill him. The U.S. and France, to a much lesser extent, has been bombing Islamic State territory in Syria. And we believe Western nations tried to kill him a few weeks before the Paris attacks.
So what exactly do we know as evidence for Abaoud's involvement in the Paris attacks right now?
Well, I think today we'll certainly get more information in terms of the types of forensic intelligence, telephone, and potentially DNA that linking him to the attack. The Western intelligence agencies had been looking into the possibility that he was perhaps directing the attack from Greece or some other part of Europe. Now, if indeed he was back in France, it would suggest he potentially was doing that right here under the nose of French authorities. It's a picture that's continuing to filter out, but our senior Western intelligence sources that we're speaking to certainly believe that he has the capacity and that he's been building up the networks to carry out this type of sophisticated attack on European soil.
I mean, he was convicted by a Belgian court in absentia earlier this year. Apparently, there's plenty of evidence against him. How did he manage to elude this manhunt since January?
I think there's some disturbing questions to answer there. I mean, I think the fact that he was potentially in a Paris suburb this morning was very surprising, given that intelligence authorities thought he was in Syria. Now, Belgian authorities would say are saying now this morning that they believe he may have actually come back into the country in January. But, you know, the broader picture here is that there's an intelligence sharing problem between European countries, and this came to the fore very vividly in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and we're seeing it again.
So, Grania, one last detail about Abaoud. He also allegedly recruited his 13-year-old brother to go fight in Syria for ISIS. And apparently, Abaoud's family was pleased to hear a report, which turned out to be false, that he'd been killed in Syria, but then were let down when they found out he was still alive. I mean, it kind of shows just what an outlier Abaoud is, even amongst, you know, the hardscrabble lives of the housing projects he comes from.
Yeah, I mean, that was really quite a notorious situation. He took his 13-year-old brother with him to Syria in 2014. And the case that we reported about Western nations wanting to kill him with an airstrike, we know of at least one occasion where they didn't order the strike because they were unsure if it was his younger brother, whose communications they were actually intercepting. So, his family sued him, and there was a court case in Belgium because his father sued him for, and we're still working on details of that, but for abducting, essentially kidnapping his son. But I think that all speaks to the very hardline views of this man.
Grania McCarthy, Paris bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Other ISIS militants have been specifically targeted with airstrikes. That includes the English-speaking executioner known as Jihadi John. The U.S. and Britain announced he was killed in an airstrike last week in Raqqa in Syria. An ISIS leader in Libya named Abu Nabil met a similar fate. Both men were tracked, targeted, and killed with help from a remotely piloted aircraft called the MQ-9 Reaper. In other words, a drone. Richard Whittle is the author of Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution. You've been following the story of drones from the beginning, Richard. How significant a role are drones playing in the fight against the Islamic State?
Well, they're playing a very significant role, but not as significant as they should be playing. You know, the Reaper carries a daylight camera and an infrared camera and radars. It also carries 4 Hellfire missiles and 2 500-pound bombs, which can be controlled from a ground station normally for the U.S. at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. Mm. You can keep them in the air for days at a time, and so it can be very useful when a target is found. But in the larger war with ISIS, the drones can't play that large a role because there aren't that many of them and they're not that heavily armed.
I got to say, I'm kind of surprised to hear all this because hasn't the Obama strategy been all about waging this war from the U.S. and not sending soldiers into harm's way?
It's certainly been their policy not to send soldiers into harm's way, not to put troops on the ground except for a few what are called forward air controllers.
But doesn't that mean you need to increase the drone kind of war?
You would think so, but they've been fighting the air war with conventional fighter aircraft and bombers. And the thing is, the U.S. Air Force owns 160 Predators and 140 Reapers, but they're not all available to fly combat missions. And the U.S. Air Force is actually very short of Reaper pilots. They say they've told Congress that in the next fiscal year, they're going to be about 400 short of the 1,200 they need, because you also have to have pilots in the seat around the clock, right? So you have to have at least 3 crews that can do 8-hour shifts. The Air Force has been forced now to do 12-hour shifts 6 days a week, and people are leaving because they don't like those hours.
Is there a correlation between the short staff in the U.S. drone program and the effectiveness of that program right now?
Well, that's a little hard to judge because, you know, a whole lot of what's done is secret, so there's no way to analyze what they're doing. I mean, the system itself and the people who operate it are generally very effective. It's one of the most precise weapons there is. But the most important role of the drone is not actually to deliver ordnance on targets, although they're the way to do it on fleeting targets or on targets that you want to stalk for a long time, as was the case with Jihadi John, I think. But they're not the way to cause the kind of destruction that will stop a fighting force that has 20,000 men carrying arms.
So, final question. Can drones stop terrorists? Can drones stop ISIS?
No, certainly not drones alone. The war with ISIS, and you know, unfortunately, it has to be a war because this is not a group that the West can compromise with. I think they've made that clear. The only thing we could do that would make them happy is to leave the planet. You know, so even if you were to produce hundreds and hundreds more drones, I don't think that would be the answer. I'm not enough of a military expert or strategist to know the magic formula for winning this war. But it seems from where I sit that it's going to require troops on the ground. I don't think that they necessarily have to be American troops, but I don't think that you can win this war from the air.
Richard Whittle is a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. I'm Marco Werman with The World. There are many different battlefields in the fight against ISIS. Here's what the digital war sounds like.
Nous sommes Anonymous. Nous sommes Légion. Nous ne pardonnons pas. Nous n'oublions pas. Attendez-vous à nous.
That's from a video by the hacktivist group Anonymous. They've declared an online war on ISIS, a war that began nearly a year ago after the Charlie Hebdo attacks. This week, the group doubled down on its efforts against ISIS. To get a better sense of what that actually means, I called up Gabriella Coleman. She's the author of the book Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous.
Really, their main intervention has been to attack and take down the social media propaganda machine. And what Anonymous has done primarily is try to locate all those Twitter accounts and report them. They have also tried to take down websites And they've also infiltrated their forums to kind of gather intelligence as well.
You know, we've heard a lot about the kind of online and digital skills of ISIS, but I think Anonymous includes even more skilled warriors in the dark web. Who has the upper hand in this battle?
Anonymous does. While it is certainly the case that ISIS has attracted programmers, engineers, nevertheless, the great majority of people who are attracted to ISIS don't have those computer skills, whereas many geeks and hackers are attracted to Anonymous. So just by numbers alone, more of them do have deeper technical skills.
How did Anonymous get into this fight ISIS business to begin with?
3 years ago, if you asked me, would Anonymous ever fight terrorists, I probably would have said no. It's not really something that was of interest to them. And it's also an operation that would align with U.S. geopolitical interests. Generally, they are kind of fighting the government, not working alongside the government. So it is very interesting that they've jumped into the fight against terrorism. And I do think that it can be explained in part by the Charlie Hebdo attacks. The important point here was that the terrorists attacked journalists. Anonymous, even though they have a difficult relationship with journalism, nevertheless believe in free press. And so they saw that terrorist attack as one against free press as well. And that helps to explain why they jumped in to the fold against terrorism at that particular point.
Right, because they see themselves as kind of defenders of free expression.
Absolutely. And had those attacks been against a different non-journalistic entity, perhaps OpISIS would have never existed.
Wow. I'm just curious how you believe Anonymous views themselves. I mean, for a lot of people right now going to fight ISIS, they look like knights in shining armor. We know also that some of their netizens are just in it for the trickster side of things, like changing traffic lights just because they could if they wanted to. So how do they see themselves?
The types of participants who are attracted to this come from different backgrounds and different walks of life. There are obviously people from France who are directly affected. This also attracts what I call military geeks and hackers. And finally, and most surprisingly, there have been participants from the Middle East. People logged in this morning from Syria saying, ISIS has affected us, they're killing us, how can we help?
Gabriella, finally, I mean, could you imagine a day when, like, the NSA or the CIA is actually working with Anonymous to take apart extremist groups?
I think it would be hard for the NSA to directly be working with Anonymous, only insofar as when it comes to many of Anonymous's other operations, they're getting arrested. That said, other groups like GOSEC, they used to be far more aligned with Anonymous, but now they're disassociating themselves, are working with intelligence. And I believe they're able to work with intelligence organizations precisely because they've disassociated themselves with Anonymous, who otherwise pisses off the U.S. government and law enforcement goes after them.
Gabriella Coleman, the author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. Thank you, Gabriella. Good to speak with you again.
My pleasure.
We're looking at a game of whack-a-mole here.
That's Vice News reporter Avi Asher Shapiro, and he's talking about the battle that's been going on for a while now between the so-called Islamic State and operators of messaging apps and social media sites like Twitter. The administrators close down one account, ISIS comes up with another one. It's a never-ending cycle. Now the extremist group seems to be using a new application. It's called Telegram.
Telegram is a really simple app that the people who make it say is end-to-end encrypted, and you can use it almost as you would use WhatsApp or Facebook to distribute messages person-to-person. But the thing that's really helpful for the Islamic State is last month they introduced the new service called Feeds, where anyone can sort of tune in to a feed information from a single source, and you tune in anonymously, and you can see everything they're sharing in real time. And there's a number of these feeds that are managed by Islamic State propagandists. And that's where a lot of the messages coming out after the Paris attack were found. And that's where Islamic State researchers and experts and journalists turned to immediately to see if there would be a statement of responsibility, which eventually surfaced on one of their major feeds on Telegram.
And is it that anonymous quality of users checking into those feeds that has kind of been attractive to ISIS?
Perhaps. I mean, one thing that I think is really important to note is that we can never be sure how secure or safe these sorts of communications are. One thing that's really important to point out is that just in the last week alone, the Iranian intelligence and Egyptian intelligence have been able to roll up certain administrators who are using Telegram to disseminate what they said were terrorist information, or in Iran, it was immoral information. So, I mean, the Islamic State obviously finds it to be useful at this moment. They've used a lot of different services in the past and gotten kicked off of things like Friendster. You know, they've used Twitter, but Twitter has done a good job of blocking their accounts. So the latest sort of clearinghouse for Islamic State propaganda seems to be Telegram. And the Telegram is started by two Russian brothers who, you know, had made it their calling to start an application that could evade Russian intelligence. And they're very, very stalwart about not shutting off channels, about not blocking people. They say it's a free speech issue. So unlike a lot of platforms where the Islamic State has spread its propaganda, so far Telegram will not kick them off. So that's a major reason why we're seeing them use it.
Have the authorities in France or the U.S. Asked Telegram to scrub ISIS from its platform? And how easy would it be to delete those users from Telegram?
You know, I don't know if they've asked them. I do know that in the days following the attack, Pavel Durov, the founder of the app, was quite clear saying that, you know, you can't blame an app for this sort of thing. It's a free speech issue. If you want to ban, he said something to the effect of, if you want to ban Telegram, you might as well ban words. And there was actually a move in the Russian Duma over the last week where some lawmakers were floating proposals to shut down Telegram. And it's been something that the app's administrators are sort of making a free speech issue.
Well, I know you've been following the feed. Aside from claims of responsibility for those attacks in Paris, what kind of things is ISIS posting?
I mean, I think that's something that people would be really surprised about. I mean, if you follow the Islamic State's social media, it really ranges from like grotesque executions and violence and military bravado to really mundane everyday stuff. I mean, if you sit down for a half an hour, you'll see reports of health facilities opening up, doctors doing operations. I mean, you'll see public bus systems. You know, there's a whole range of media available. It's not just a place to disseminate like macabre snuff videos. And that's a main part of their propaganda, right? Just to say that life goes on here, life is normal here.
Avi Asher Shapiro, Vice News there. And there has been an update since my conversation earlier today with Avi. Telegram says it's now shut down some of those ISIS propaganda channels on its app. How does our government vet incoming refugees? Find out ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Syrian city of Raqqa is controlled by ISIS. This man, who calls Raqqa his home, speaks of danger everywhere.
I take a very high level of risk just to speak with you.
And he says he's caught between ISIS and Russian airstrikes.
Russian kill us by the sky and ISIS kill us by the ground.
That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The American political debate over refugees from Syria has taken on a religious tone lately. GOP presidential hopefuls Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz have both suggested that admitting Syrian Christians is okay, but not Muslims. President Obama said that such statements play into the ISIS narrative about a clash of civilizations, you know, the West versus Islam. Well, there's a high-stakes debate about the threat posed by ISIS going on right now among Muslims, too. From the World's Religion Desk, here's Matthew Bell.
If anyone says Muslims aren't condemning terrorist attacks like the one in Paris last week, they just haven't been listening. From the heads of state in Muslim countries to this guy, who identified himself as a Moroccan named Wafi Abdus in a YouTube video, Muslim denunciations of ISIS have been plenty.
I know that by now people do realize that these people are not Muslim. They don't represent Islam because they're not. They don't represent what we believe in. These so-called jihadists or fundamentalists, they only represent themselves. And I just wanted to extend my deepest condolences to the French people.
The fact that ISIS kills in the name of Islam is what disturbs Hesham Hasaballah most. He's a physician from Chicago who writes a blog called God, Faith, and a Pen. For Hasaballah, the extremists of ISIS are guilty of blasphemy.
We live in a time where religious faith may not be important to many people. It still is to me. It's still a very precious gem and jewel that I hold on to very strongly. So if someone, some savage, tries to take that precious thing and defile it with murder, defile it with barbarism, defile it with cold-hearted bloodthirstiness, that's offensive. And I'm not going to fight them on the battlefield. I'm not, but what I can do is speak out against them in the strongest manner possible.
Muslim religious authorities have denounced ISIS as heretics. Sheikh Mohammed al-Yakoubi, who's originally from Syria, goes so far as to declare them apostates. That's a little like excommunication in the Catholic tradition, but in Islam, apostasy is a capital offense. During a recent speech at Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California, Yakoubi told his audience that the followers of ISIS have deviated from Islam and that Muslims have an obligation to fight them on the battlefield and beyond.
ISIS is a religious group, is an Islamic group. You cannot fight ISIS based on security alone. You have to have Muslims, scholars telling you how to save the minds of our next generation from being brainwashed. War starts in the minds of people.
But other mainstream Islamic scholars have stopped short of saying that ISIS is guilty of apostasy. Shadi Hamid says there are good reasons for that. He's a scholar at the Brookings Institution and the author of Temptations of Power, a book about Islamist movements in the Middle East.
This idea that you can kind of render someone who claims to be a Muslim outside the faith sets a very dangerous precedent. And it's worth noting that's exactly what ISIS does. That is their legal and theological reasoning. They essentially argue that the vast majority of Muslims are not true Muslims, that they are in fact apostates, and therefore their blood is licit.
Politics comes to play in all this, of course, says Mohammed Fadl of the University of Toronto, and that explains why Muslim political leaders in places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt are hesitant to name ISIS as the enemies of true Islam.
The Sunni states in the region are either unwilling or incompetent or unable to intervene to stop ISIS. Once you sort of escalate it, again, by declaring ISIS to be an apostate regime, an apostate state, right, that puts more pressure on them to do something.
For their part, ISIS seems to take this stuff seriously. It divides the whole world into two camps. There's ISIS and its supporters on one side, and then everyone else, including most Muslims, who belong to the enemies of ISIS. The extremist group has singled out Muslim scholars who have condemned its violent tactics. ISIS calls them apostates. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Let's turn now to the American debate over whether to admit more Syrian refugees into the country. That debate has been growing louder lately because of security concerns following the Paris attacks. French investigators say one of the gunmen there may have entered Europe posing as a Syrian refugee. The fear then is that ISIS could do the same thing here. Several governors who've called for a halt to refugee resettlement have said the issue is about vetting. So how does the U.S. government screen incoming refugees? I spoke about that with Max Rosenthal. He's written about the refugee vetting process for Mother Jones, and he told me that the number of Syrians admitted by the U.S. since 2011 is pretty small compared to the millions of Syrians who fled their country.
The stats that I looked at today say just over 2,000. I believe it's 2,227. It's really a drop in the bucket, both of that refugee stream and even of the refugees who come to the United States every year.
So how does that number of 2,000 plus Syrian refugees coming to the U.S. compare to, say, the numbers going to Turkey or Jordan or Germany and Sweden?
I mean, in comparison to either the Middle East or Europe, it's a minuscule number. In Lebanon is a country of maybe about 4 million people. UNHCR, which is the UN Refugee Agency, estimates at minimum that there are just over a million people, and that is a conservative estimate.
Wow.
So you're talking about well over a quarter of the population of Lebanon is now made up of refugees, mostly from Syria. You have millions more in Jordan and Iraq, and of course, Germany is going to see anywhere probably from 800,000 to a million alone. There are thousands of people coming into Europe every day, so it's just a dramatically different situation.
So walk us through the whole process for Syrian migrants and refugees who want to come to the U.S. What is the process like?
It's a long process. It takes a minimum of 18 months. Some cases go up to even 3 years. And it starts basically with the refugees applying for refugee status. They make contact and they send in an application to the United States. UNHCR helps identify which candidates might be good for resettlement in the United States. Often that has to do with whether or not they have family members here. And then the Department of Homeland Security is going to take those applications and they're going to vet them. They're going to send people out. They have a group called the Refugee Corps that goes out and interviews these refugees wherever they are, whether it's Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon. And they go through a really long screening process trying to verify the stories that these refugees are telling them, trying to make sure that their identities are what they say they are, trying to make sure that there's not a security threat and that they have no known connections to any terrorist groups or anybody who's really going to affect the security of the United States. It's important to note that even if they go through all those security checks, even if the security officer kind of gets a bad feeling, they're saying, look, these guys go through all the screening and their details line up, but there's just something about this guy that strikes me the wrong way. They have the discretion to say no to those refugees. So they're going through a really kind of lengthy and what the government considers thorough process.
I'm curious, where do Syrian refugees typically wait while they're being vetted? I mean, if they end up in Europe, is it harder then to get to the U.S. or do they have better chances if they're in a refugee camp?
It's important to note that the United States is vetting these people in the Middle East. They're not taking people who have made their way to Europe. You know, so much of the focus has been on refugees that go to Europe. But don't forget that the overwhelming majority of refugees are still kind of trapped without resources in the Middle East. And those are the people the United States is talking to, people in Turkey, people in Jordan.
Now, the U.S. government has added another layer of screening, apparently, for Syrians called the Syria Enhanced Review. What can you tell us about that?
Essentially, when a person delivers their application to the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, the Department of Homeland Security and other intelligence agencies and security agencies are taking that information and they're essentially going through it before the applicant is going to get their in-person interview. So that way, when the security officer goes to interview them, they kind of have this file that says, all right, here's what this guy says. Here's what this family says. We've taken a look, examined what their claims are. Here's a set of specific, more focused questions that you can ask them to kind of make the vetting that more in depth. So that's something that only Syrians are going through because of the security concerns, obviously, that are arising from the civil war.
Max Rosenthal, formerly with The World, now a reporter in Washington with Mother Jones. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
All the concerns about admitting Syrian refugees now have a historical echo in this country. Americans had similar concerns back during World War II. Back then, the fear was that German spies would hide among Jewish refugees. Listen to this newsreel clip from 1942.
The spy net tightens. Searching this war prisoner exchange ship, the FBI seizes Herbert Karl Barr, accused as a Nazi spy.
The FBI used the capture of Carl Friedrich Barr as proof that its vigilance was warranted. Reporter Daniel Gross re-examined the case for Smithsonian.
Carl Friedrich Barr was born in Germany, and he came to the United States as a teenager. And so he was naturalized, grew up in Buffalo, New York. But in 1938, which is, of course, right before war breaks out, he went back to Germany to study engineering. And there, the FBI accused him of meeting with the Gestapo and going to spy school, where he was given $7,000 to steal industrial secrets from the United States. So he sneaks back into the United States, posing as a refugee, but he gets caught right at the border.
Right. So he goes to trial, and it was a capital case. How did his arrest and the trial impact Jewish refugees?
Well, at the time, the fear of spies, German spies, was rampant in the United States. It was sort of taken as a given that Germans were lurking among us. And I would say that this case gave extra ammunition to people who were already suspicious of refugees.
Was the fear in the United States about German spies teeming in this country, was it legitimate?
Well, of course, Carl Friedrich Barr was convicted as a spy, but his case is practically unique. Late in the war, the Treasury Department started getting a bit skeptical of the State Department and the FBI claims, and they kind of ran a fact check on this supposed security threat. And they said that you can count on one hand the number of refugees that actually did pose a security threat of the sort that Karl Barr did. And of course, Karl Barr was not actually a refugee. He was just pretending to be one.
All right, so parallels with today. What can we learn today with the Syrians fleeing the war in their country, seeking new homes in Europe, but also here in the U.S., where the allotment has been raised from 1,900 admitted over the past 3 years to 10,000, getting legal status here by the end of this fiscal year?
Well, I asked several historians whether they saw parallels between the Jewish refugees in World War II and the Syrians today. They were cautious. They wanted to point out the differences here, but they did all agree on a couple things. First, that making generalizations about a people based on a couple incidents, it's dangerous and it could potentially be counterproductive. That was something that was true with Jews. It was also true with Japanese Americans, and it could be true with Syrians, they said. And the other thing that they agreed on was that rushing into policies in the immediate aftermath of an attack or a security threat can have long-term implications that we should be very careful about. So short-sighted decisions in the past, they've had very long-term implications.
So from where you are right now in Germany, Daniel, which has been really generous allowing in refugees and migrants, although there's been some kind of reexamination of that generosity, I know, are you seeing a similar paranoia going on now?
Yeah, I would say the story is similar to the United States in that some politicians have expressed fear that refugees could be a security threat. That idea was floated before the attacks in Paris. But at the same time, one of the German ministers for security said that the refugee crisis could radicalize right-wing Germans against refugees. And so there's kind of this effect on both sides of security threats, not just from refugees, but against refugees.
Reporter Daniel Gross in Berlin, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Thank you.
We've been focused for a while now on stories related to the Paris attacks and their aftermath, but we are following other news happening around the globe. So let's take a quick look at some other stories that caught our attention today. One story from Nigeria is sadly not entirely unrelated to Paris. Two bomb blasts rocked the northern Nigerian city of Kano today. The explosions reportedly went off near a busy mobile phone market. Police say at least five people were killed, including two female suicide bombers. The militant group Boko Haram is suspected, but has not claimed responsibility. The attack comes just a day after another suicide attack in Nigeria that killed more than 30 people. In Australia, the threat today is from wildfires burning out of control. Authorities there say several fires raging across southwest Australia were probably ignited by lightning. Four people have been killed in one of the blazes near the coastal town of Esperance. A heat wave and strong winds are helping to fuel the flames in what's already been a deadly start to Australia's bushfire season. In a more positive bit of environmental news, sort of, there should be fewer new coal power plants being built around the globe. The U.S., Japan, and other major industrialized nations announced a compromise agreement on the issue. It limits export financing for the construction of new coal power plants. That's how American or Japanese technology, for example, is exported to build coal plants in other countries. The Obama administration says that should stop most new construction, but the deal still allows subsidies for plants using the most advanced technology and for those planned in some of the world's poorest nations. The plan has already come under criticism by environmental activists. And finally, I'm sure there will be naysayers about this next story, too, and whether it's even news, but here goes. People magazine has announced its choice for sexiest man alive. It's British soccer star David Beckham. Americans will remember he played here with Major League Soccer a few years back. He's now retired, but apparently still dashing as ever. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're going to return now to the story of the Paris attacks. Earlier today, thousands of people held a vigil in the Molenbeek district of Brussels. That's where it's believed some of the perpetrators of the Paris attacks had been living. The World's Jeb Sharp was at that vigil, and she joins me now. Why was there a vigil?
Marco, the neighborhood feels completely beleaguered, not only by police raids, but also by journalists from all over the world asking questions about why it creates so many extremists and terrorists, which for any community is a pretty horrible way to be painted. And people just said, you know what, we are not all terrorists, and it's totally unfair to paint this community of 100,000 as if that is the case. And we want to come out and show our support for Paris and our support for the families of the victims in Paris. And we want to say, we are not all terrorists. We are all in this together.
So how many people showed up? What was the mood?
It was a really lovely thing. It was still daylight when it began, and people just started assembling. And then the few organizations that had put it together began laying candles in the shape of the word Molenbeek. And so the O was a peace symbol, and there were the plaza was covered in candles. And then more and more people came. And as dusk fell, they began to light the candles. And then literally the plaza just filled up. And when it got to a certain capacity, the police blocked it off. And you couldn't come in, you could only come out, because they wanted to be sure they kept it secure and safe. So there were actually more crowds outside. The beautiful sunset, pink clouds above these rather grand buildings, and the municipal building for Molenbeek is at the one end of the square, and it was flying the French flag from the tower. Really lovely sort of setting, lots of kids, very mixed crowd. The community is about 40% Moroccan descent, and they were definitely out and about and in the mix.
What is this neighborhood of Molenbeek like? Because I understand, unlike the suburbs of Paris, which are the kind of like high density immigrant populations, Molenbeek, it's in the center of Brussels.
Yeah, it's just outside the center, just across a canal. And it used to be a medieval village, and it became an industrial part of town, a really humming part of town, I think, in the 18th and 19th centuries. But it kind of fell on hard times, and now has a very high rate of unemployment, something like 40%. And it has grander bits and seedier bits, and has a lot of problems, but also has a lot of spirit. It was really interesting seeing that crowd there today. There's a real feeling of being among the majority of being misunderstood, them wanting to tell the world, yes, we have these problems, but we are also moving and shaking and changing and growing.
I mean, that's nice to hear. I'm just wondering, did you get a chance to speak with anyone about these very real ties to extremism?
Well, it was interesting because people ran the gamut from what they were willing to say and the kinds of things they did say. But one of the main organizers, she's actually a concert organizer at a venue in Molenbeek and works with a lot of youth, said that in the last few days, there's been a lot of anecdotal conversation about the fact that there is recruiting going on in Molenbeek, and people are very concerned about it. And there was a feeling that people knew stuff and hadn't spoken up, and that this had to be a turning point, that if people know about stuff, they have got to name it and contact the authorities.
Right. And it wasn't just the Paris attacks. There were previous attacks linked to this neighborhood as well.
Yeah, and even in the last few days, it's pretty overwhelming. Two of the suspects had ties to the neighborhood. The alleged mastermind has ties to the neighborhood. And then the two lesser suspects who apparently provided transportation for one of the surviving perpetrators also hailed from Molenbeek. But yes, other terrorist incidents also had ties to this place. So you can't wish it away. You have to face it, and the authorities have to face it. Tonight was just a night for the community to say, we're here too, and we want to be part of the solution.
The world's Jeb Sharp in Molenbeek in Brussels. Thanks so much. We'll talk with you soon, Jeb.
Thanks, Marco.
Finally today, that's reportedly the sound of explosions in the ISIS stronghold of Raqqa in Syria. I say reportedly because the audio was recorded by the Syrian opposition group, Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. We reached out to the group via Viber and talked to one of their spokesmen, who goes by the name Zaid Al-Thabet. We can't verify his location.
I'm now on Raqqa City. I can give you like a specific details, about my security, my safety. I can do that for you. If anybody knows that's who I am in reality and I am speak with you, I will be executed by ISIS.
Zaid said he has heard 5 separate bombardments since the morning. Those might have been from the French Air Force, who have been striking Raqqa for the past 2 days. But Zaid says he's much more worried about the Russian airstrikes because they're more indiscriminate.
To be honest, there are no place on Raqqa when the Russian planes come. There are no place on Raqqa is safe. We feel that maybe any second we will be dead because they're targeting everything. Last week, there were 3 civilians. They were killed by the Russian strikes. And before that, there were 5. And there are a lot of civilians killed by the Russian strikes.
Zaid says for people in Raqqa, ISIS is a daily reality.
We see them everywhere because they control everything. And when we walk on the streets, we see them. And when the time of a prayer come, they being in the streets and they told everybody that you must close your shop or where you are working and go to the mosque to do the prayer. So we see them many times every day.
He admits some Raqqa teenagers have joined ISIS, some for the money, others because, as Zaid puts it, they've been brainwashed. And he says he's worried about criticizing the extremist group in front of his own children.
I can't speak with my children truthfully. That's really a problem because, you know, that our children, maybe when they go outside of my home, they one of ISIS members or the streets, maybe speak with them and ask them a question, and they will speak the information that they hear it from me. And it will really be a problem for me. So I make like in the middle. I stay in the middle. I told them that we don't hate anyone and we don't want to fight.
Zaid says he's worried about his own safety. Two of his colleagues with Raqqa is being slaughtered silently were tracked down by ISIS and killed in their homes in southern Turkey last month. So Zaid says he's taking extra precautions, like using an old model cell phone. He's also stopped smoking because ISIS forbids it.
I take a very high level of risk just to speak with you. It's very, very risky for me. But even if it's risky, I take that risk just to reach the voice of people on Raqqa to say that we are against ISIS. We hate them. Please believe us.
Zaid says that sometimes he and other Raqqa residents feel desperate and worry that the fighting will never finish. But he's holding out hope that someday ISIS will leave Raqqa because it's his home. And Zaid gets the last word today on the world from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.